Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Day two for Pope Leo XIV. We'll talk a bit about that. And you know what else we'll talk about? Whatever you want, because it's an Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin, both hours today, 888-318-7884. And if that's not enough, there'll probably be some groovy music. So that's a lot of things going on this hour and next. 888-318-7884. Ask Me Anything is open to anyone. You certainly do not have to be Catholic to call. And you know what? Your question can be about anything. Jimmy loves talking about just about anything. So if you've got a question, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. He's the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, a very well-known podcast, and then a growing podcast, the Jimmy Akin podcast. And you see him also on many other podcasts, and he's a writer of, I look at the stack of books. I could go through some of them, but the Bible is a Catholic book, The Fathers Know Best, Teaching with Authority, and the stack, I can work my way through that stack, but it's a lot, so we'll just leave it there. Lots of books from Jimmy Akin. Hey, Jimmy, how are you doing today on day two?
I'm doing just fine. How are you doing, Cy?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm still, I'll be honest with you, a bit flabbergasted that we got an American pope. I just, that is something, I guess my whole life people have been saying, there'll never be an American pope. And I internalized that.
Yeah, well, that was the conventional wisdom. And I suspect at one point in time that may have been true. But cardinals, you know, are trying to figure out who the best guy is among their number. And I saw a press conference that was being held by various American cardinals today. And they said that they, once they got into the discussions, people from around the world who were cardinals were asking them about Cardinal Prevost, and they weren't concerned about the fact he was an American. Mm-hmm. You know, as an American, if you always hear it's not going to be one of you, then you can kind of internalize that. But that really wasn't a concern for other folks. And I think it's kind of similar to when Pope Benedict was elected, because he had been, he was from Germany and of the World War II generation, and he had been forced against his will to join the Hitler Youth as a young man, because all German youth were required to. And some people thought that would just be a deal breaker for him. But it was clear in all the decades of his service since that he totally opposed the ideas of the Nazis and had no sympathy for them. And it just wasn't a concern. Also, there was concern about the fact he had had to be, he had, as the head of the then Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, he had had to, you know, administer discipline at times to various errant theologians, and people thought that would be a deal breaker. But he was, people in the conclave saw his kindness, his gentleness, and that his reputation was not what did not correspond to the reality, and it just wasn't a concern for him.
Yeah, yeah. I went back, Jimmy, and I read some of the pre-conclave prognostication, and Cardinal Prevost was actually on many of the lists. I think I just glossed over it because he was an American. I was like, oh, he is there. It's not like nobody saw this coming. It's just that I was editing it out as it happened.
Yeah, well, and, he seems to have taken to the role, and he seems very comfortable in it. Yeah. One of the things I'm planning on doing is doing a video. Now, I did a video yesterday with my first thoughts about Pope Leo, and I'm planning on doing a second video about how the four most recent popes met the world as pope, because they come out on the loggia. at St. Peter's, and there are differences in how they present themselves. Even before they say anything, they present themselves, you know, physically to, you know, what they're wearing and what they're doing with their arms and what they're doing with their face and everything. Mm-hmm. And I found video going back to the second conclave of 1978. I couldn't find the first with John Paul I.
Oh.
But beginning with John Paul II, I got video of all four of those loggia appearances for John Paul II, Benedict XVI, Pope Francis, and now Pope Leo. And there are marked differences in how they present themselves, especially Pope Francis.
Yes.
He is clearly the outlier. And frankly, you know, I never speak ill of or strive not to speak ill of a reigning pontiff. But as soon as Pope Francis came out, he just stood there.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't it was not like John Paul II. He was or Benedict. He wasn't waving and smiling and things like that, using his arms. He was just standing there, and for an uncomfortably long period of time. And I said to myself at the time, back in 2013, this is a bad sign. Uh-huh. It's like he doesn't understand what's required of him in this moment. And I think, you know, that was an accurate prognostication in some ways. I think that his instincts did not always correspond for what to do to what was needed in the moment. But then when you see Pope Leo come out, he's doing what he needs to. He's smiling, he's waving, he's dressed in the traditional vestments, and he seems very comfortable.
Yes.
Despite the right. enormous pressure. I mean, Pope Benedict compared the moment when he realized that he was likely to be elected to watching a guillotine fall. You know, he did not want the papacy.
Yeah.
And because there's enormous pressure. I mean, the room that they take the Pope to vest before coming out on the loggia is called the Room of Tears. And, you know, I guess some popes, newly elected popes, have actually broken down.
Yeah.
Emotionally from assuming the weight of the office, and they need a little bit of time to compose themselves before going out and greeting the public. Because there's just enormous pressure with this job.
Yeah.
And yet Pope Leo, he comes out, he's smiling, he's waving, he seems very calm, he seems very serene. And I think those are all good signs.
I felt wearing the Mozzetta. Did you see that?
I noticed that. Yeah, he was dressed in the traditional papal vestments for this occasion, and that was a sign of continuity with popes prior to Pope Francis. So you know, it's like, okay, I'm Pope now. I'm going to do what's expected of popes.
Yeah,
and that was a good sign. I've also been reviewing. Now, he doesn't have the kind of paper trail that Joseph Ratzinger had. I mean, he was a theologian, and he had been active for decades writing stuff. And so we knew a lot about his views. Cardinal Prevost doesn't have that kind of paper trail, but he does. There are records of, you know, him giving speeches and things like that. So I've been listening to his speeches and public appearances, watching public appearances he's made where he talks and interacts with people and takes questions. And I'm very encouraged. One of the things that they had back in 2012 was Synod of Bishops on New Evangelization, and he made a speech there, and he later read part of that speech, which is available in video. It's on newadvent.org today, but he talks about media manipulation and how the media tries to normalize abortion and the homosexual lifestyle and things like that. And so he goes down a list of issues like that. I thought that was all very positive. Also, one of the things he mentions is that the church's response to this, you know, given the way things are presented in pop culture, should not be to make worship a spectacle. Instead,
good for him.
Instead, it needs to invite people to appreciate mystery as an antidote to spectacle. And that suggests to me that his liturgical sensibilities are similar, very similar in that respect to those of Pope Benedict XVI. And for people who may be fans of the traditional Latin Mass, I can't say that he's going to take any action to re-liberalize it, but saying that we need to not have spectacle in worship and that we need to have an invitation to appreciate mystery as the antidote to spectacle, that's at least a positive sign.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. What did you think of the name Leo? Did you have any thought upon hearing his name was Leo?
Yeah, I thought one thing, so there are sort of two elements. I've made a very careful study of Pope names. In fact, a few years ago, I published an ebook about them because I crunched the numbers on all of the Pope names in history. And one of the things I found in doing that is there are certain periods in church history where popes have gotten tired of the recent names, and they start reaching further back in history. And we've been in one of those periods when John the 23rd became Pope. Now, we had a whole run of
mostly Piuses.
And I think that name has kind of run its course for now.
Right.
But when John the 23rd was elected, he reached back centuries to get John. Paul the VI then reached back centuries. John Paul the I reached back forever because we'd never had a John Paul before. Mm-hmm. That was a brand new papal name. Now, then he died after just a month, you know, like 33 days. And that put the church in crisis because that was not an expected conclave. And so in crisis situations, popes may take the name of their predecessor. They don't usually do that, but that explains John Paul II as a sign of continuity.
Yeah.
Don't worry, I know my predecessor just died, but we're going to be okay. Benedict reached back basically a century. Pope Francis was another brand new name. And then Pope Leo reaches back more than a century, just a little more than a century, because Leo the 13th died in 1903. So that's, 122 years ago now.
Yeah.
So that kind of fits with the naming patterns of popes either coming up with something completely new, which John Paul I and Francis did, or reaching back very substantial periods of time. One of the things that communicates is I'm my own man. Don't expect me to be a copy of any of the recent popes, including my immediate predecessor.
Yeah.
So that signals his own identity, and it signals continuity with Leo the 13th, who is credited as being the first pope to really engage the modern world. His predecessor, Pius the 9th, had famously, during his reign, he lost the papal states and Italy became a consolidated country around the Vatican. And Pius the 9th went into a kind of self-imposed exile in the Vatican where he wouldn't go out again. You know, he retreated. He very much opposed what was happening. And then Leo the 13th said, okay, the time has come. We need to engage this world. We may not like everything about it, but we need to engage it. And he wrote, the first major encyclical on the church's social teaching, Rerum Novarum, which is Latin for new things. And so I think that some of those, now, of course, it's up to Pope Leo the 14th to explain exactly why he chose his name, and they often do that. So we're likely to get some additional insight coming here. But I thought it was good that he didn't just call himself John the 24th or Paul the 7th or John Paul the 3rd or Benedict the 17th or Francis the 2nd, reaching back like that and kind of saying, I'm my own man. I think that shows confidence, and it also indicates we shouldn't just read his papacy through the lens of one of his immediate predecessors. Now, actually, if he had chosen John Paul III or Benedict the 17th, I wouldn't be too unhappy. But if he had picked John the 24th or Paul the 7th or Francis the 2nd, I would be less confident. Mm-hmm. And the fact he went back so far, regardless, even if he had chosen John Paul III or Benedict the 17th, that would make his pontificate polarizing. Because people who didn't like John Paul II or who didn't like Benedict the 17th, they would immediately be hostile to him. And by picking Leo the 14th, he sidestepped the politics involved in recent popes so that nobody is going to say, oh, I hated that guy. So he's not going to have built in, you know, not for that reason. He's not going to have built in opposition from the beginning of his papacy by just saying, don't compare me to anybody recent. I'm my own man. Take me for what I am.
Yep. Not a lot of people walking around with big resentments for Leo the 13th. There's not a big man. I hate Leo the 13th contingent. So all in all, then it seems like a very hopeful start.
I'm hopeful now. Yeah. You know, popes encounter problems, and no pope is perfect, not even Benedict the 16th, who I loved. So I don't expect that there are never going to be any storm clouds, but I'd say this is a very hopeful start. I'm impressed by what I've seen so far, not listening to some of the hot takes you get from some of the angrier corners of the Catholic internet world, but actually just listening to what the man himself has said, I'm optimistic.
Jimmy Akin, our guest, it's Ask Me Anything. All the lines are full, so we'll take questions right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Are you looking to study Catholic theology in a formal way with the guidance of faithful scholars? Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by the Augustine Institute, offering master's degrees in theology, pastoral theology, and Catholic education with flexible study options on campus, online, or both. The Augustine Institute equips students to serve Christ and His church in schools, parishes, dioceses, apostolates, and the home. Learn more today at augustine.edu.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
This is Father Leo Paddlinghug, and why do we need Catholic radio? Well, the answer is simple. The devil, who is very real, uses all forms of communication. And so if we are to understand our purpose in life, it's to make sure that we are not only proclaiming the good news, we're also listening to the good news. And how do you do that? With Catholic radio.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Jimmy Akin is our guest. It is Ask Me Anything today on Catholic Answers Live. You want to talk about the events of recent days in the church? You're welcome to call and ask your questions. You want to talk about anything else? You're welcome to call and ask your questions. Everybody's welcome. Let's start in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, where Nolan is listening on our app, the Catholic Answers Live app. Nolan, welcome. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So I have a question about a rare condition in twin pregnancies called twin reversed arterial perfusion sequence, where one twin is sometimes referred to in medical literature as a parasitic twin, and it's severely malformed. In these sorts of situations, intervention might be required to save the viable twin, which often results in the death of the other. What does the church teach in these types of more complicated cases that are not as straightforward? And is it ever morally permissible to intervene in a way which might lead to the death of the less viable fetus to preserve the life of the healthy one? And I guess sort of a part two, more broadly, how does the church understand the ensoulment of fetuses with severe genetic or developmental abnormalities? So, like, at what point would the church say this? I'm trying to be careful with my words here, but does this organism not have a soul? And okay. I'd like to add that under normal circumstances, I understand that, you know, ensoulment happens at conception. So I do understand that under normal circumstances. But
all right, let's ask a question.
First, I have a follow-up question. Nolan, is this a practical situation or are these hypothetical questions?
Nothing regarding, you know, in my life. It's a hypothetical, but I was researching some pro-life stuff and I learned about it, and so I wanted to know.
Okay. So if it were practical, I would refer you or anybody in such a situation to the National Catholic Bioethics Center because they're the experts on this. I can give you – I have not studied this particular pregnancy complication, so I'm just going on what you've described. But the basic principle – is that what's called direct abortion is intrinsically immoral and therefore can never be performed under any circumstances, even if it means that someone else is going to die. And what direct abortion is the killing of an unborn child, either as an end in itself, meaning it's your goal to kill the child, or as the means to another end. So, like, I'm going to kill this child in order that something else may happen. However, there is another scenario where the child's death is foreseen, but you're not killing it as a means or an end. In this case, the child's death is a side effect of something else you're doing. The sort of classic example of this is in connection with another pregnancy abnormality, which is a tubal pregnancy, where the unborn child implants not in the mother's womb, but in the fallopian tube and begins growing there. And if nothing is done, the fallopian tube is going to rupture, the child will die, and the mother is very likely to die as well. And so how most Catholic moral theologians handle that is they say you can't directly kill the child, but what you can do is remove the fallopian tube. Because the child has already damaged, by implanting in it, the child has damaged the fallopian tube. And so you can remove the fallopian tube, even though, or part of, you know, a segment of the fallopian tube. And you foresee that the child is going to die, but you're not attacking the child. You're not killing the child directly. And you're not killing the child in order to accomplish something else. What you're doing is you're removing a segment of the fallopian tube that is now damaged. And you just foresee that the child is going to die as a side effect of that. And that is not direct abortion. And so that, by most Catholic moral theologians, is considered okay. It's tragic, but it's okay. And in the future, the child may not have to die, because we already have Mark I artificial wombs. We call them incubators. And as incubator technology improves, we can save a child earlier and earlier in pregnancy. And so we may well, within a few decades, arrive at a point where you take out the fallopian tube and transfer the child into either we may be so good at that point with surgery, we can transfer the child into the mother's womb, or fail in that, into an artificial womb, into a souped up incubator, and save the child's life. So that's just an illustration of how in this scenario, you're not attacking the child as a means or as an end. Now, people could debate about the fallopian tube procedure I just mentioned, but the principle holds. You can think up some other scenario, but as long as you're not killing the child directly or killing the child as a means to some other goal, you can potentially, for grave enough reasons, you can take action that will lead to the death of the child as a side effect of the procedure, but you can't directly attack the child. So that's the governing principle here. So that, I believe, deals with your first question. What was your follow-up?
How does the church understand the...
Oh, the soul question. So the church does not actually have a teaching on exactly when ensoulment occurs. The standard so this is not a matter of doctrine. This is a matter of theology. The most common theological opinion is something I'll explain once we get back from the break.
That is what we call a tease. Hang on there, Nolan, and anybody else who's listening. We will find out what the church teaches on ensoulment. Our guest is Jimmy Akin. The number is 888-318-7884. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun, and that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests. He does on-air debates. And he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Deepen your connection to the Church's holy days and seasons while you draw on the wisdom of the Church Fathers. Feasts of Our Fathers, the new book from Mike Aquilina and Adam Lucas, is a treasury of history, prayers, insights, and lessons that will bring you closer to the earliest of Catholic traditions. Take your prayer life and your solidarity with the Church, past and present, to a new level. Order your copy of Feasts of Our Fathers today at shop.catholic.com.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Hi, this is Janet Benkovic-Williams. There's nothing like Women of Grace to explain the truth of our faith Monday at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Nolan on the line from Oklahoma City, and Jimmy left Nolan and the rest of us with a bit of a tease. What does the Catholic Church teach on when the soul is present? When does ensoulment happen?
Yeah, well, some of us might want to listen a little bit closer, because you teased my answer, as after the break we'll find out what the Catholic Church teaches about ensoulment, and I just said that the Catholic Church doesn't have a teaching on this.
Yes, exactly.
So this is a matter of theological opinion rather than doctrine. But the common opinion, which Norman seems to share, is that the human soul is present from conception. Now, Norman's question, though, was where is the boundary for what's going to count as a human soul? And I should point out, even though Norman spoke in terms of a soul being present, the standard theological opinion is that every living organism has a soul. Because as James 2:26 says, the body without the soul is dead. So if you have a living body, if you have a living organism, it's got a soul. The question is, what kind of soul does it have? And the human soul is had by a human body. And modern genetics, at least in most cases, will tell you, are you looking at a human or not? Or are you looking at something else, like a carrot, which would have a carrot soul, or a rabbit, which would have a rabbit soul, or so forth. But the church does not have a teaching on where the boundaries are. And so this is between a human soul and the soul of something else. And so this is a matter of theological, medical, moral speculation. And I can imagine medical, moral theologians having different opinions about this. Now, there are obviously some genetic defects that, even though they're genetic abnormalities, they're not going to cause a person not to be human. For example, various humans have a condition known as trisomy, which is where normal humans have two copies of every gene. Or with the exception of our sexual genes, where we have, if you're a man, you typically have an XY chromosome pattern, and if you're a woman, you have an XX chromosome pattern. In humans, other species, not necessarily, but that's what it is for humans. But normally, like if for our other genes, like let's say gene 20 or chromosome 21. Most of us have two copies. We inherit one copy from our mom and one copy from our dad. But occasionally something goes wrong and we get someone is born with three copies of a gene, of a chromosome. And that is the condition known as trisomy. So if you have three copies of chromosome 21, you have trisomy 21. You've got three copies of chromosome 21. And that is what causes Down syndrome. But people with Down syndrome are still people. And so you can have a significant genetic abnormality in that regard. You still got a human soul. Now, if you have something that's radically different, like you've got half of a regular human genome, I can imagine medical moral theologians who are Orthodox having different opinions. I haven't studied that question, but at some point there would be such a low amount of genetic matter present that I could imagine some Catholic medical moral experts saying, I don't think this is really human anymore. It's just, there's not enough of a human genetic code there to count this as a human. On the other hand, I can imagine others having the reverse opinion and saying, I don't care how little it is. If there's any human DNA in this organism and there's no rabbit or carrot DNA in it, then it's a human. But so I think that this is an area where people who are experts in this area can have a difference of opinion. Unfortunately, at this point, there's not much of a way to resolve those differences in opinion, at least not at the present stage of doctrinal development, because the scriptures and apostolic tradition doesn't know anything about genetics. Chromosomes had not been discovered when Christ and the apostles were walking the earth, and so they didn't tell us anything about chromosomes and how much you need, how many you need, and of what kinds in order to be a human. But that's kind of a sketch of the area at present.
Nolan, going to leave it there. Lots of folks on the lines. On we go. Audrey's in Denver, Colorado, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Hello again, Audrey.
Hi, Si.
So, welcome back.
God bless new Pope and peace to both of you.
Oh, thank you.
Also, I wanted to tell you, Si, my 2-year-old has decided that the Catholic Answers live music means you specifically.
Oh,
she says, Si!
Oh, that makes me very happy. Well, thank you very much, Audrey.
But so my question was, I heard an assertion at a retreat this weekend that Hocus Pocus is actually derived from the Latin expression of this is my body and the institution of the Eucharist at the Mass. Mm-hmm. Is that true? And is it the same idea as like modern witches stealing book, bell, and candle instead of talking about excommunication?
Well, okay, so that we'll deal with the first question first. It is often claimed that Hocus Pocus is in English, because it only exists in English, except unless other languages have borrowed it from English. Hocus Pocus is something that originated in English. It's commonly claimed that it's a mocking parody of the words of consecration, hoc est corpus meus, this is my body. And that's a very common claim. I have never seen it rigorously documented. The earliest reference that I'm aware of to the use of this phrase in English goes back to the 1500s, if my memory serves. And after the time of the Protestant Reformation in England, there was a performer who seems to have been kind of a juggler who also did magic tricks. And he called himself His Majesty's Most Excellent Hocus Pocus. That was his stage name. And he would juggle and he would do magic tricks and he would entertain people and so forth. And he had a set of magic words, kind of like abracadabra, that he would use. And I may not get him exactly right, but my memory is that they're hocus pocus jubilate deum or something to that effect. And it seems like he was, even though it's mangled, when I have looked at it, the exact words he used, it was like parody Latin. It was mangled. It didn't really mean anything in Latin, but it was clearly meant to evoke Latin. And so even though I've never seen it rigorously documented that Hocus Pocus is based on hoc est corpus meum, how that noun should be inflected at the moment. But even though I've never seen it rigorously documented that it's based on the words of consecration, I think it's reasonable to propose that. So I would say that's the answer to the first question. You then asked if it's the same thing as witches use in bell, book, and candle, and instead of talking about excommunication. Now, where bell, book, and candle comes from is that's pre-Reformation. It comes from the rite of anathema, which was a kind of ceremonial excommunication that your bishop could impose on you. Now, today, a lot of people have completely erroneous ideas about what anathemas were. They'll say it means stuff like damned by God and stuff like that. Well, that's not what it meant in canon law in church history. It, by the Middle Ages, it referred to this special ceremonial excommunication. And I say ceremonial because there was a ceremony that had to be performed. If you had committed a serious enough offense, your bishop would haul you down to the to church, and he would impose the anathema on you with a group of 12 priests. And there was this special ceremony. And the bishop, as part of the ceremony, he says, look, I've warned this guy 3 times, and he's still doing this bad thing. He hasn't repented. So now he's going to be excommunicated with an anathema. And they, like, stripped the shirt off your back and stuff like that. And at the conclusion of the ceremony, they would close a book indicating the our judgment is done. We've written it down. The book is now closed on you. And they would ring a bell, which signals the court is not meeting anymore. And then the 12 priests who had been standing around in like a semicircle holding lit candles would take their candles and throw them all on the ground. And so this signified this dude is excommunicated with an anathema. This is the highest form of excommunication. And then they had for when you repented, which of course was the purpose of the excommunication, to get you to repent. When you repented, they had another ceremony where they would lift the anathema. So you'd come back to the church and they'd do another ceremony to take the anathema off of you. And you'd be restored to fellowship with other Christians. Now, that's the origin of the phrase bell, book, and candle, because they closed a book, they rung a bell, and they threw down the candles. But somehow, by the mid-20th century, this became associated with the idea of witchcraft. And there are various, like there's even a mid-20th century movie, if I recall correctly, called Bell, Book, and Candle that's about witches.
Jimmy Stewart.
It's a comedy.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
Not that funny, but.
Yeah. So I don't know that any modern witches actually use this phrase. They may. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. I just don't have verification that real world witches, as opposed to Hollywood witches, actually use this. But that's what's going on with Bell, Book, and Candle.
All right, Audrey.
Alrighty, thank you so much.
Audrey, it's well known that 2-year-olds love Jimmy's book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. So if you'd like a copy of it, hang on and we will send it to you. I better take a break, actually. I better take a quick break. Right back with more Ask Me Anything with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend? Coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, we train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
EWTN. Teaching the truth.
Thank you so much for all that you do, and your mother Angelica and her words. I'll never forget the first shows on television when I found her, and that led me to the radio station.
I'm an 8-year homeschooling mom. I'm a veteran of doing this for a long time. What encouraged me was this beautiful nun named Mother Angelica, and one day she said, well, if you don't like the school, why don't you just pull them out and homeschool them?
The number, it's Ask Me Anything. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Randy's down in Alabama. We're glad you're here with us. Randy, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. What does no attachment to sin, even venial sin, mean?
Okay, so I assume you're asking this, Randy, because that's one of the requirements for obtaining a plenary indulgence, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah. Okay. So attachment to sin can involve one of two types of attachment. One could be attached to sin by the will, or one could be attached to sin by the affections. And so an example would be, you know, let's say. And I don't know if Cy Kellett would have sympathy with this or not, but let's suppose you're just way too interested in pizza, and you're tempted to overeat pizza.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, so you would have an attachment of the will there if you know about your temptation to overeat pizza and you are not making any plans to cut off that temptation. In that case, your will would be partially, even if you're not eating pizza right now, you plan to overeat it in the future. And so you have an attachment of the will to overeating pizza. On the other hand, let's say then you decide, okay, I'm going to cut that out. I really want to overeat pizza, but I am just not going to do it. I'm just not going to overeat pizza. And even if I'm attracted to overeating pizza, I'm just not going to do it. And in that case, you've turned your will away from overeating pizza, even though your affections are still attached to you. The idea appeals to you, even if you're going to refuse it. The idea appeals to you to overeat pizza, overeating pizza under ordinary circumstances being a venial sin. Okay. So those are the two forms of attachment that could be at play in this requirement of having no attachment to sin, even venial sin, when it comes to gain and a plenary indulgence. And I've seen it articulated both ways. I know a Catholic theologian who has said, well, it's obviously attachment of the will that is meant, because no one could ever guarantee that their emotions, their affections, aren't gonna be attached to venial sin. And so as long as you exclude, you say as an act of will, I don't want to do any sin, even venial sin, then in that moment you would be fulfilling the requirement to gain a plenary indulgence. And his argument is basically nobody could ever fulfill it if it was your affections that also had to be detached from sin. On the other hand, I have read a document on the Vatican website. I don't remember exactly where on the Vatican website, but it dealt with indulgences, and it suggested, at least based on my reading of it, that all attachment includes not just attachment of the will, but also attachment of the affections. And so I've seen this articulated both ways. Now, what I don't know for a fact, but I strongly suspect, is that the document I read was not on the Vatican website, was not a magisterial document. In order for something to be a document, something the magisterium teaches, it has to be signed off on by the Pope. And the Vatican crunches, they just churn out a lot of paper, or these days, a lot of websites, a lot of web pages. And so a lot of what you actually find on the Vatican website is actually not magisterial. It's just the opinion of whoever wrote it. So I don't know that that what I read on the Vatican website, if I read it correctly, has any more authority than the opinion of my theologian friend. So I can't tell you for sure what the answer is, but those are the two ways I've seen it argued.
I am going to leave it there to try to get more on, Randy. I very much hope that is helpful to you. I am having an affection for pizza at this very moment, so on I go. Michelle in Augusta, Georgia, listening on 91.9 FM. We're glad you're here, Michelle. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You were talking earlier about the popes and their names, and so I just wanted to know if anecdotally you knew when the cardinals typically decide what name they're going to choose, because I'm guessing that, you know, if they wait until they're elected, that's kind of a little bit late, and they probably have a lot of things, you know, going on in their head at that point.
What so, name they're going to choose when they're elected pope?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I do. I know exactly when it happens. It's the second question that they get asked after their election. The first question they're asked after the vote total reaches 2/3 plus 1 is, do you accept your election to the papacy? And if the cardinal who's been elected says, accepto, I accept, he becomes pope that moment. Unless for some reason he's not already a bishop, but all the cardinals are, in which case they'd ordain him a bishop and consecrate him a bishop, and then having accepted the office, that's when he would become pope. But assuming he's a bishop, as soon as he says, I accept, he's pope. The second question he's asked is, by what name do you wish to be called? And that's when he decides what his papal name is going to be. And he has all kinds of options. He could, even though no pope has done it in more than like 1,000 years, he could pick his Christian name, his baptismal name. He could pick the name of a previous pope he admires. He could pick a brand new papal name like John Paul I and Francis did. But it's before they even notify the public. It's before the white smoke appears. So it's the second question that gets asked after the first question actually that gets asked after he's accepted his election to the papacy. And sometimes it may take him a few minutes to think about it. Now, I suspect a lot of popes, as they begin to see the votes accumulating, they start thinking about, oh, if I'm elected, what am I going to call myself? So they don't all need a lot of time, but reportedly some of them do. They haven't really thought about it enough, and they can need a little bit of time to figure out what they want to be called.
Michelle, I'm going to leave it there. I hope it was helpful for you. On I go. Joshua is out here in Menifee, California, watching on YouTube. Joshua, if you can be a bit quick with your question, that will give Jimmy an opportunity to answer it. Joshua? No Joshua in Menifee?
I think. Sorry. I was on mute. Sorry
okay.
About that. Sorry about that.
All right. Go ahead. Okay. Try a little bit quick, though, Joshua.
For sure. My question is, is Mother Mary the highest / like greatest like creature? And if so, how does that relate to what Jesus said about John the Baptist being like the greatest born among women? I don't have the exact text, but yeah.
Yeah, so Mary is commonly regarded as the greatest of all creatures because she, at least the ones God's told us about, because she got to be the mother of Jesus the Messiah, and she therefore would be greater than John the Baptist. Now, Jesus is famed in the Gospels for saying that of those born of women, there's been none greater than John the Baptist, which would suggest that John the Baptist is very favored along some spectrum of measurement of greatness. But Jesus follows that up by saying, but he who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater even than John the Baptist. And the kingdom of heaven is here very likely to be taken as a reference to the church, because Jesus is going to be introducing the kingdom of God. That's the original proclamation of the gospel. You know, the time is at hand. So God's going to establish his kingdom now, and that's been done through Jesus in the church. So, Sykelet, did the Virgin Mary join the church?
Well, I would say yes.
Yeah, she did. So Mary is in the church. So does that mean she's greater than John the Baptist for that reason alone?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, that would suggest that. Yeah.
And so is every other Christian. But among Christians, Mary is uniquely the one who got to be the mother of Jesus. So she's even greater than an ordinary Christian. So if we were composing a pecking order here, you've got various Old Testament prophets and so forth. John's at the top of that. Then you've got the least Christian. Then you've got the other Christians, and then you got Mary at the top of the Christian world, and then you've got Jesus himself above that.
All right.
Interesting. Wait, so you know, I don't want to sound like blasphemous or whatever, but like, is the quote unquote like least Christian, like are you and me like greater than like Moses, or I mean you know?
Well, that seems to be what Jesus is saying. There is a sense in which John the Baptist is the greatest of the Old Testament era because he's the herald of the Messiah, and that would imply that there's a sense in which John the Baptist is greater than Moses. And now what we're doing here is we're relying on standards of judgment that can be swapped in and out. I mean, by one standard, John is the greatest of the Old Testament era, and the least Christian is greater than John the Baptist on that standard. But there are other ways of measuring value or greatness. And so if you apply a different standard, the same judgment might not apply.
Joshua, thank you very much for getting to your question pretty quickly there. And I'll tell you what, there's going to be three lines open during the break. There have been no lines open at all for the first hour. So now's an opportunity to call and get in the line to talk with Jimmy. 888-318-7884 is the number. It's Ask Me Anything. And whether you are Catholic or not, as a matter of fact, whether you're Christian or whether you're a religious person of any kind or not, you are welcome here to ask your question. 888-31-TRUTH. We will take a very quick break and be right back with more Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.